we had jumpers with our names on it, so it said Roger Pennine Radio. Any idea that there was much cooperation between Water 1 and PM, yeah, forget it. She took her headphones off and put them on the table so she could no longer hear me.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which we talk to those who made a difference. Roger Mosey.
My granddad was somebody who loved radio and was very, very taken when Radio Leeds had started. So the first I became aware of local radio at all was when Grandad started listening to Radio Leeds. And you saw that for someone who was by that stage living on his own, that the intimacy, the locality, the connection of the presenters with him was something that really mattered to people.
Leeds and the World at One. This is Alan Shaw reporting.
So I was part of that generation that listened to Two-Way Family Favourites and some of those great light programme classics. I also remember waking up and listening to the very first record on Radio 1 in 1967.
P.O. Box 1AA.
And I suppose then the real engagement with radio was actually, as a bit of a nerdy grammar school boy in Bradford, was listening to Radio 4 in the early 70s, in which I discovered The World Tonight. And The World Tonight is probably a rather austere and higher ground way into proper radio, but I loved Douglas Stewart on The World Tonight and just having that sense of the events of the day. And then I even used to listen to Today in Parliament, which in those days was before there was sound from Parliament, so it was just a straight read. But I loved all that sense of Heath and Wilson and the cut and thrust in politics and how that came out on the radio. And it really did quite a vivid job of conveying what was happening without using the range of techniques we'd have today.
What is the IRA? That's the first question I put to the president of the new Sinn Féin movement, Thomas McGeolo, when he talked to me from Dublin.
I was incredibly excited when, as a Bradford schoolboy in 1975, there was going to be commercial radio. And I'd been listening to commercial radio in the mid-70s when LBC and Capital started. I'd heard those and I was very excited about them. And I'd followed the way that commercial radio had spread around the country. And I think you have to put yourself in that era which was very rationed for the amount of choice that you had, and you only had the BBC. So the idea of getting a fully-fledged commercial radio station in Bradford was really inspiring, and it sounds odd, but of course they were pretty much full-service radio stations in those days, and they had big newsrooms, and they did a classical music programme, they did book programmes, they did ethnic minority programmes, they did the whole lot. So it felt like you were having your own broadcasting service for your home city, and that I was incredibly excited about, you know, again, in a very nerdy way.
You'll hear local, national and international news on the hour and half hour, keeping you in touch with what's happening in Bradford. There's what's on programmes, chat shows and lots of music. Let Pennine into your radio. Pennine Radio, your radio, starts next Tuesday at 6 a.m.
Well, I listened to all the test transmissions. I remember the very first morning with someone you know, Steve Merrick, who was the original presenter on Pennine Radio Breakfast. But I was there listening to every moment of it. There was a great woman called Liz Allen who did The Late Show, which was quite rocky and progressive rock, which in, you know, when you're 18, you like that sort of stuff. And I volunteered fairly early on to go and work at Pennine. And I think I'd also managed to arrange a visit before then as well. So I went in one night for, I can't remember what Paul Needle's show was called. It had some terrible name like Needle's Eye or Needle's Ear or something. And I think I went in to help with a guest who was going in and really was determined to try and get my way into this wonderful radio station that was happening in my hometown. Wrote to Austin Mitchell, who was the big TV personality in Yorkshire doing Calendar, and Austin was also a director of Pennine Radio and had his own show on it. So I wrote to Austin and said, I'd love to help on one of your programmes, and I mentioned his programmes, Tops and Noils, which was a Sunday night programme, and he wrote back a very jokey letter saying that he didn't know anybody under 90 listened to Tops and Noils, but he's very pleased if I would help out. And when I went to Pennine, I met Dorothy Box, who has been a great friend of my life, and Dorothy was then the community affairs producer, and Pennine had an access slot. So fairly rapidly, I ended up making a half-hour programme about Bradford Grammar School. And that was the first time I'd ever done things like edit tape and go and record interviews. So I was 18 at the time. And Pennine let me do that programme. And then, as someone who was about to go to university, I did some summer work there, helped out on Doris's programme and some other programmes, and was the lad that you're familiar with from local radio who collates the football results on a Saturday afternoon and does the Travel for Breakfast show. And all of that was just magic for me because I loved radio so much. Off to university, and at university, I suppose one of the reasons I'm so pleased now to be here at Selwyn is that I didn't really want to be at university as much as I wanted to be making radio programmes. So every vacation, I would go home and do the breakfast travel news and all those Saturday lad jobs in local radio. And I made documentaries as well. So I remember doing a big documentary that Jeff Winston commissioned about education, which was quite a big take on the crisis in schools, political response to it. And those are the kind of programmes that Pennine would run in an 8 o'clock in the evening slot. So I was making those during vacations. And it meant that I was never very interested in student media because I felt I was doing proper media. And the thing which I look back on, and it chills my blood a bit thinking about what I would respond if one of my students now did this, but in 1979, I was doing finals in June 1979, and in May 1979, I went back up to Bradford for the general election, and I went out with Dorothy, and we did the count at, I think, Skipton and Ripon. And I was working on the general election programming for Pennine rather than revising for my finals. And I would have a fit if somebody did that now. And I did. I worked credibly, I think, and I did okay in my degree. But all the time I was doing my degree, I really just wanted to work in radio and do proper radio. And that was the great joy of my life at that time. I did the usual milk round and was interviewed by people for various jobs. I was interviewed by Thompson's, who ran the newspapers, and I was actually offered a job on the Newcastle Journal. So that was probably January 1979 or February 79. I also applied for a job with London Weekend Television as a researcher on Oracle, the teletext service, and I was offered that. And then I was talking to Jeff Winston about, was there anything going at Pennine? And Jeff made me an offer to be community affairs producer at Pennine. So having this prestigious newspaper group or London Weekend Television, I chose Pennine, which was a real decision of heart over head, I suppose. Worked out brilliantly in that Pennine gave me massive amounts of responsibility at the age of 21. I was essentially running the speech side of the station, both the daytime speech content and then some of the evening speech content. And I suppose that intensive running of part of a radio station gave me fantastic experience, which Thompson's and LWT wouldn't have done in the same way. It obviously didn't do me any harm going to Pennine, but it was a slightly mad decision just based on what I loved doing.
What's that, Mum?
It's Bradford City Hall Chimes.
But isn't it a new tune?
Yes, it's so you can spot messages from the Telegraph and Argus each time they're given on Pennine Radio.
Oh, I see.
Pennine has probably one of the most unprepossessing sites of anywhere because it's in the basement, or it was in the basement of a wool warehouse, and you were therefore subterranean pretty much all the time. It was full of people smoking, it was full of very, very bad coffee. It was also populated by, I suppose, all commercial radio stations had their lovable eccentrics, and we had Julius K. Scragg, we had Roger Kirk, we had Dorothy herself, and Pennine, I suppose, personalities really build up in those radio stations, and it had a lot of oomph in its personality for what, in retrospect, of course, when you look back on it, it was a small operation. But it had real ambition and fire in what it did, and I really regret that we've lost those commercial radio stations which were the dominant force in their city, and everything you wanted to know about your city was on that radio station. So I'm hugely affectionate about Pennine, and I remember that we used to do things like we had jumpers with our names on it, so it said Roger, Pennine Radio, and we'd go out into the shopping centre and give people stickers and do outside broadcasts. I've done the whole lot, and it's invaluable experience, and I regret today that people don't have as much of a full range of options within a local radio station as we did.
It's 18 minutes now before 7 o'clock, 18 minutes before 7. And at 7 o'clock we'll have the latest in news for you nationally, see what's happening in the world around us. And
I suppose in those days part of me still wanted to be a disc jockey, so I remember when I applied for the BBC I went for general producer jobs which were more on-air presenting, and I think I realised fairly rapidly after that I didn't really have the voice or the personality to do those kind of programmes. I always liked the connection with an audience, so stuff that we did like seeking furniture for Vietnamese boat people who had been resettled to Bradford, that thing where you can say something on the radio and then something happens. And on the community show, we'd all be about raising volunteers and putting people in touch with other people who could help out. And I don't want to impose a view which became a later BBC view about the activism role that media can create. But local radio at its best does have this sense of community.
So how is Pennine Radio going to differ from all the other stations on the radio at the moment? Because the dial on your radio is absolutely crammed with them.
The dial is not crammed in Bradford and West Yorkshire.
I applied for general producer jobs in BBC local radio and wasn't getting them, but what was happening was that the people I was applying to for general producer jobs were saying, why don't you become a reporter? And Radio Lincolnshire was a news station just about to start in 1980. So in the spring of 1980, Roy Corlett, who I'd met once before when he was interviewing for the BBC Local Radio Reserve, but Roy offered me a reporter job at Radio Lincolnshire, and I thought, well, you know, the BBC seems to think that I'm a reporter, so probably I should be. And I'd had no news training at all. I'd had no journalistic training. So Roy's introduction to me at public meetings was, this is Roger, he's a reporter, and he's never worked in news, at which point he would laugh uproariously. After I'd been in the BBC doing news for 3 or 4 months, I was sent on a news conversion course, which I don't even remember those, but they were designed to take general producers or DJs and give them a sense of how news operates. And we were taught T-line and court reporting and how to write copy, all that sort of stuff. So I was given some training by the BBC to become a reporter. Day one of working in the BBC was in July 1980 in the old Langham building when it was the local radio training headquarters. And in those days, they gave you first-class travel. So I travelled first-class from Bradford to London for this new job. People like Jeff Link and Robert McLeish, who were running the local radio training unit. And it was a very, very good training. We worked together on how we wanted the radio station to sound. And whereas I think with commercial radio, you get together much later and closer to the date, we had this huge luxury of a period from the 14th of July, my first day on the BBC, to I think it was the 11th of November we came on air, so plenty of time to get it right and to move into Lincolnshire and start doing all the test transmissions and the dummy programmes.
Good morning to you on the birthday of BBC Radio Lincolnshire. I've got two very good neighbours here in Lincoln. One of them's very old and the other's very young.
I was working on the night shift or the evening shift the day we went on air, so I was the late reporter getting all the stuff ready for the next day. And I did this gripping report about a potential fire strike in Lincolnshire, which was the first local voice piece on Radio Lincolnshire. But otherwise, I was set myself the alarm to wake up and listen to Nick Brunger introducing the first ever Radio Lincolnshire breakfast show.
It's 7:10 on Tuesday, the 11th of November, 1980. And for the first time, there's a warm welcome to the programmes of BBC Radio Lincolnshire.
There's a magic in being the first media in a county. And again, Lincolnshire had not had a radio station. It had Hereward down the south in South Lincolnshire, but there'd been no radio station in Lincoln. And suddenly people in Lincoln get a radio and they love it. That pioneering with a big beast for a local area is exhilarating, and you know, you suddenly get people realizing what they've been missing and taking part in this wonderful local radio station that then means a lot of people. And again, when Radio Lincolnshire turns up with the mini metro with the Lincolnshire tulip on the side, people are very excited because it's something which is making a difference in your county. And I got to love all that. And Lincolnshire, partly then because my parents moved there 3 or 4 years later, is my second home, really, after Yorkshire.
We're broadcasting on 94.9 stereo VHF and 219 metres, 1368 kilohertz in the medium wave.
Roy Corlett as manager was a really distinctive force, and I've loved Roy over the years. Roy was rebellious and swashbuckling in BBC local radio terms, and we were brought up with a healthy disrespect for all management and all corporate centres and all London people. And Roy really wanted to run a radio station that he believed was the right sort to run. And I think there was a lot of autonomy for local radio in those days. But Roy was so much fun to work with. You also were pretty terrified sometimes of Roy, that he had this old newsman's commitment to hitting all the stories, and the worst thing he could do was not see a story in that morning's papers that Roy was reading at home, and he'd be reading his paper at home, and if he didn't hear it on the Radio Lincolnshire breakfast show, he would want to know the reason why. And then combining with Roy very effectively was Dave Wilkinson as programme organiser, and Dave was again one of those radio men who absolutely understood the medium, was very good on the technicality of it. So Roy would set out a grand vision and Dave would make sure it actually happened and there was a schedule there. And we were very young crowd, so we were all in our early 20s. And I think you have this challenge of how a bunch of people in their 20s, not from Lincolnshire, know how to run a radio station predominantly listened to by older people in the county. But I think we got that right, partly because Roy was so clear about what the target of the station was going to be. We had voice training done by David Dunhill and by Jimmy Kingsbury. I don't want to emulate it too much, but that was where they very much wanted you to intonate in a way that would convey the meaning of a story. So the Financial Times index is up 27.3 points and the weather is going to be showery and gloomy. And you had to try and introduce this personality into your voice, based, I suppose, like the classic football results, Leicester City 3, Arsenal 2. And that you had to make sure that you didn't lose the meaning of the words that you were reading. And they were very old school, but it was useful. I probably would never sound like they would. And David Dunhill in particular, I think, was a legend of Radio 4 and other radio stations' continuity and presentation.
The time is just now 10 minutes to 12. This is David Dunhill, and this is the end of the home service for today and for all days.
It was good training, and I think in commercial radio, I got no training whatsoever. I was just sort of thrown into the job, expected to do it, and if you didn't do it, you'd have been fired at the end of the week, whereas the BBC has a much more structured and at times forgiving attitude to people who don't know their way around stuff. I so enjoyed doing a new radio station at Lincolnshire that I wanted to do a new station at Northampton. So I stayed at Lincolnshire, I suppose really only just over a year of actually being on air, but Northampton were advertising for producers, which was a promotion from where I would have been. And again, I saw in Mike Marsh someone who was rather entrepreneurial and swashbuckling. And at that time, Radio Northampton was deliberately designed to suit a new town and a much younger population. So whereas Radio Cambridgeshire was set up to appeal to the university and to a rather posher county, Northampton was very much 25 to 34, new town, people who've moved out of London, and we were quite a top 40 radio station with Beatles bonanzas every morning and a very un-BBC local radio style.
You're listening to the final test transmissions of the country's newest local radio station. On these wavelengths, a few minutes from now, you'll be able to hear the start of the local radio service for the county of Northamptonshire.
Of course, being a news producer, I was more in charge, I suppose, of my own output, producing the breakfast show, having the say in what kind of stories you cover. And I enjoyed that, though I suppose if I'm honest about it, I never warmed to Northampton as a town in the way that I did to Lincolnshire.
Let's have a look at some of the stories we're going to be dealing with in the programme this morning. We'll be finding out what local anglers got up to in the dead of night. We talked to the Northampton businessman who's just won a multi-million pound overseas order.
We had Look East in the studio, as you do, to record, and they caused the most enormous ructions by wanting to plug their sound into part of our apparatus and causing howl round at one point. So if you listen to the very first morning of Radio Northampton, there's a moment of howl round caused by Look East. And then reading the first bulletin with cameras on you, which is an extra stress level. But I remember vividly the first news story, which was that General Galtieri said that the Falkland Islands still belonged to Argentina, because it was indeed at the end of the Falklands War. It had just ended.
It's 7 o'clock. This is Roger Mosey. Good morning. The headlines this Wednesday, the 16th of June. General Galtieri has told...
Mike Marsh, who was also a very competitive chap, had determined that we would have three or four stories that morning, which knocked the Northampton Chronicle and Echo for six by surprising them about the original stories we'd come up with. So we spent weeks working on new and original stories that were going to really... So it was a fantastic bulletin, probably the best local radio bulletin we ever had, with two or three exclusive stories to get us underway. And there was this mix, as you always get with a new station, of adrenaline and excitement, and you're never sure that anyone's going to be listening to you. I suppose when you look back on it again, the fact that we were the first ever radio station in Northampton meant that you couldn't really fail, and indeed we didn't.
You're listening to BBC Radio Northampton on 1107 kilohertz in the medium wave and 96.6 stereo VHF.
You have no idea when you're sitting in a BBC local radio station what they do in London. You've no idea what a sub in a newsroom is, as against a producer, as against someone on World Service or someone in television. So I just applied for a few jobs, and in those days they had a scheme which essentially put you into a pool for the Radio 4 sequence programmes. And I was offered an attachment, and I was chosen to go and work in special current affairs programmes. What they actually had within their portfolio was The Week in Westminster, Yesterday in Parliament, Inside Parliament, and then from our own correspondent, Letter from America, a range of programmes on Radio 4, which were really weekly programmes. That was the most wonderful training, combined with the fact I love politics. So if you're a political anorak, as I was, being able to become fairly rapidly the producer of Yesterday in Parliament and The Week in Westminster meant that I had a House of Commons pass, and I could go and watch Mrs. Thatcher from the gallery of the House of Commons and make programmes about it. And I think that gave me both an understanding of the way network current affairs works and also how to put programmes together in a much more coherent way. And that was an eye-opener, really, for the way that you construct built radio for Radio 4. It felt incredibly humbling in a way, and I think I even felt that at the time, that to imagine that I'd only been probably 3 years, 4 years out of university, and there I was able to watch the political greats of the day and to choose in a week in Westminster which ones I put on the programme. And the power that you have in those days, and I think the BBC was very, very good at letting you get on with it. And there was a wonderful man I met called Robert Carville, who was the political editor of the London Evening Standard, and Bob was one of the presenters of The Week in Westminster, and he must have been early 60s and I was early 20s, and Bob was a mentor and guide through Parliament, and he would give me little pen portraits of the big politicians, and he'd have very clear views about how he wanted The Week in Westminster to sound. And I'd occasionally come up with a former Pennine Radio kind of ideas, like, why don't you say good morning as opposed to just coming on air? And he would think about it and say, do you know what, you may have a point. And he would then, to my great joy, say good morning at the start of the programme, and I would think, this is revolutionising radio as we know it. But I think that's where I so value people who've got time for young producers. And it wasn't always the case. Some of the people doing The Week in Westminster just regarded you as the person who'd get the clips out and do all the running around, whereas Bob flattered me into thinking that I was working with him and had equal views on one of Radio 4's iconic programmes.
It was when I first became an MP back in the 1960s, and it was rather solemn, very serious. Did actually report what happened in Parliament, unusually compared to now. But it was an agreeable programme, and it was, you know, very Radio 4.
And I think probably I had no real sense of a hierarchy in the BBC for many years. I think it was one of the good things about our editors that they never let us know there was a hierarchy above. And certainly on the Today programme, when we heard there was someone called Editor News and Current Affairs Radio, I was only very vaguely aware who it was and what that person did. In that time, the hierarchy was utterly mysterious, and they never seemed to encroach on what we did. And I think the striking thing is about the amount of power that you had. So the risk that you might commit a mistake were there, but they really trusted you to get on with it, do the job. And almost never do I remember someone overruling an editorial decision or saying, well, we can't do that. You're trusted to produce programmes. You get it wrong most when you go into a big programme like the Today programme. So after I'd done 6 months on attachment with Special Current Affairs, I was interviewed for the Today programme, got a job as a producer on the Today programme. You're there working on in the highest spotlight that there is, and you're on the programme more scrutinised than anything else, and you're 25, 26, whatever it is. And of course, you do make mistakes. And I said in the book, and I was kind in the book by saying that some people at the time were drinking quite a lot, and therefore one of the functions that we had as junior producers was sometimes to carry on with the programme when our seniors were possibly slightly too poorly to do it themselves. And that was a very good learning curve for us, but also frightening. So you would sometimes be sitting in a studio making a decision on something that was quite big, and you might or might not have coherent support behind you. I had a wonderful editor called Julian Holland who taught me an immense amount, but editors in those days, again, had a rather more Olympian detachment from programmes than would now be the case. So Jules would not ring in and ask you what you were doing on the programme the next morning, and he'd come in probably around 8 o'clock and wouldn't give you any particular feedback on the programme until the morning meeting following. So when the programme was on air, there was no sense of, hey, Roger, are you doing the story about Libya? It would just let run its course, and only afterwards would you think, oh gosh, I really should have done that. Now, I think editors these days, and certainly I'm afraid me, were much more interventionist in that we would be talking to the night team, we'd be guiding them at 2 o'clock in the morning sometimes, and at 6 in the morning I'd be looking at the running orders and helping reshape it.
Well, now, let's take the other expenditure that people are worried about, expenditure on education. Now, we've got a new education
system. No, with respect, they're not worried about expenditure on education.
Oh, I think they are. No, I'm
terribly sorry, Mr. Timpson, they're not. They're worried about the standards of education. Nothing to do with money, but it's ruining education.
It's all right for me to ask a question.
Oh, sorry, indeed, indeed.
The presenters were John Timpson and Brian Redhead. They were pretty intimidating. And as against Week in Westminster, where you've got nice old Bob Carville, who is doing a day job as well as Evening Standard political editor, you have these people who are used to a large number of junior producers coming through your programme. They are national institutions, and there's this kid from Bradford or local radio who is there trying to tell them what to do. And it was a pretty tough battle. And I respected, I think Timpson and Redhead were the best ever combination of presenters I worked with. They didn't like each other particularly, but they had a generosity of spirit in the way they worked together. And if one of them came up with a funny line, the other one would know not to try to trump it. You sometimes hear today people going, yeah, let me tell you another funny story, and it just doesn't get any funnier. Whereas these two had a real professional understanding of what had clicked with the audience and not to try and outbid each other.
Do you think we should have a 1 minute silence now in this interview? One, for you to apologise for daring to suggest that you know how I vote, and secondly, perhaps in memory of monetarism, which you've now discarded.
But they could be really intimidating, and there was one morning as studio producer when I'd actually taken the instruction of my editor and I'd run the short version of a package, not a long version of a package, and the short version meant that Timpson and Redhead had a minute to fill. So I said, I held the talkback key down and said, you've got a minute to fill here. And Redhead went berserk and ran out of the studio, came into the control room and shouted at me, I'm going to have you sacked, he said. You're not going to do another programme, you're going to be sacked. And then ran back into the studio and did the, and it's coming up to 5 to 8, and did a perfect 1 minute fill. And Brian could be pretty volatile. I came in the end to really like him and work with him very successfully. But, you know, when you're 25 and you're directing a national programme and you've got the presenter doing that, it was terrifying. And you'd sometimes have a senior editor saying, you know, tell them what to do, make sure they do it. And you're thinking, well, that's easy for you to say, but, you know, how do I tell these national institutions what the next line should be?
And now, as promised, a letter from America by Alistair Cook.
I went to New York for a while to be the BBC New York producer, where the main job was to service the Radio 4 sequence programmes, but you also had, as a weekly thing, producing Letter from America with Alistair Cook. And Alistair would come in every Thursday, usually. And Alistair was charming and an utter delight, though the unspoken thing about Alistair was he smoked a lot, and that meant that he coughed a lot as well. So the most onerous thing about Letter from America was having to edit out something like 27 coughs or splutters that Alistair had done. And of course, when you listen to the programme, it was so smooth and perfect, and he was very adept at just picking up where he'd left off. But that was a brush with another great figure.
Good morning. Propped up there against my usual three pillows and reluctantly having just finished a favourite bed book.
And then pretty rapidly after that, I got promoted to senior producer on Today. And then when I was 29, I was lucky enough to be in the right place at the right time when the John Burt revolution happened. So in came John Burt as Deputy Director General and as the head of News and Current Affairs. And frankly, he cleared a load of people out and promoted lots of young people. So I became editor of PM at a ridiculously early age of 29. And of course, that's one of those BBC things where if you can edit a programme, and I suppose looking back and sounding immodest, but I could edit a programme. I knew how to edit a current affairs programme by then. But there's no rationale at all for why you can then run a budget and 30 staff and be in charge of all the things that come with editing a programme. So again, you're just chucked in there with no knowledge whatsoever of HR or finance or anything at all. You're just expected that because you can edit an edition of the Today programme, you can become an editor and a manager. Well, the very first morning, I went into the office and there was Valerie Singleton. And Valerie Singleton was so famous for my generation as the presenter of Blue Peter. And then she'd also matured in her broadcasting in the same time as I was growing older. So she went from Blue Peter to Nationwide and the Money programme and various other things. So she was utterly famous. And if you went into a restaurant or a bar with Valerie Singleton, everyone would look at you. And, you know, she was really well known. So I suddenly think, oh my goodness, I'm in charge of this woman who I watched on Blue Peter. And she said to me, almost the first thing she said was, I bet when you were watching Blue Peter, you never thought you'd be my boss. And she was indeed right. That when I was sitting watching Blue Peter age six, I didn't think I'm going to be that woman's boss.
Now, if you're, say, eight today, in the year 2000, you'd be 37 years old, and you could well be watching Blue Peter with your children.
So it's intimidating. You also realise very rapidly that you are the person that everyone turns to for both editorial advice and career advice. And I think I must have been incredibly raw. And at that time, I, you know, when you're 29, you're pretty brash and competitive. And I shudder to think, in a way, what I was like on some of the managerial sides. But I saw my job as being an editor. It had been, weirdly, mostly recorded. And all the interviews and the two ways of the correspondence were done at about 4:45, topping and tailing them, chopping them off and starting them again, which I didn't really understand. I thought, why can't you do all this live? I mean, it's a live news programme. So we really changed from having maybe only one live item per programme to sometimes trying to do a completely live programme. And I think it was partly based on a suspicion that the programme producers had that Valerie, as a non-journalist, wasn't really adept at doing live interviews. And I think that was wrong. I think she was very good at them. My favourite headline in that time was The Telegraph and Argus from Bradford came to visit, and they called it Rogers Radio Rush Hour. And I love that idea that you've just got a whole bunch of things happening around the world and you create this rather chaotic live programme. And of course, PM has now changed again, and I think he's much more built around Eddie Mayer and Eddie Mayer's personality. But we made it a very smash-and-grab news programme, which was massive fun to do, though also, you know, the adrenaline was pretty intense, I suppose. I mean, you realise that presenters put themselves on the line day in, day out, and that if you say to somebody, I don't like your voice, it's actually quite a personal thing to say, or they can have to make a live decision at very short notice. So they're the vulnerable people, and you're there to provide the support for them. And I think that what I suppose I became good at was working with presenters and presenters trusting me. So ultimately, the trust is a crucial thing. So they know that you're going to make the right decision or give them the right question in their ear or support them if they run into any bother. I think my really strong belief about network radio and some local radio is that that presenter-producer combination is what really makes great broadcasting. And it was always set in the World at One. The great icons in the World at One were William Hardcastle as a presenter and Andrew Boyle as his editor. And it's the two together who really take it into a different level.
PM.
PM, you may remember, had a really horrible theme tune, which sounded like it was banging the bottles of Coca-Cola together. It was sort of bing, bing, bong, bong, bong. And when I got the PM job, Ron Neal, who was John Burt's number two right-hand man as running News and Current Affairs, said, "You must get a new theme tune." And Ron had worked with George Fenton on Newsnight. So George Fenton was commissioned to write a PM sig tune, and we went down to his house in Chiswick, and he gave us some ideas, and then he came up with, I think Gillian Reynolds, who's of course the supreme arbiter of everything, called it a jolly galliard, she called it. So anyway, it was a jolly galliard. And again, this is where I love Val. Val absolutely got that it had a sort of opening riff, and then it had a bed in which you could do three headlines. And poor old Gordon Clough never got this idea at all. So Gordon would be sitting there mysterious and the drumbeat would come in and Val and I would know that that's where you start doing the second headline. And Gordon would sort of look into space and not have any idea about it. So it wasn't a complete fit with the presenters of PM. And with both Gordon Clough and Bob Williams, we used to have to record it and we would shout at them when they had to do their headline.
It's PM at 5 p.m. with Frank Partridge and Valerie Singleton.
Tonight, reports of 100 Soviet tanks heading for Boris Yeltsin's Moscow headquarters. Bush tells Yeltsin, "We support your bid to restore Gorbachev to power. Europe takes economic action." And the government announces plans to prevent another pin down, but there are claims it still continues.
It was pretty traditional, really, that a load of editors of PM became editor of World at One and then Today. There was a pattern, really, that on the whole you promoted within Radio 4, and it still happens to this day. And the World at One is probably the most satisfying programme, I think, for a journalist to do, in that you start from a blank sheet of paper at 8 o'clock in the morning, so some days you had literally nothing booked at all between 1 and 1.40. And you would then come up with a programme which you hoped would shape or shake the political world by 1 o'clock.
The World at One, this is Robin Day with 40 minutes of news and comment this Tuesday lunchtime.
And one of the other powerful influences of that time was Kevin Marsh, who... Kevin was deputy editor of World at One when I was editor of PM, and then he became editor of PM when I was editor of the World at One. And Kevin and I were fantastically competitive, and we would sometimes hide stories from each other and laugh at the way we tried to stitch each other up. But it was very, very competitive. Somebody floated the idea that the Today programme at the end of it might say the next sequence on Radio 1 is the World at One. And the Today programme utterly refused to do it on the grounds that they were promoting a rival. Any idea that there was much cooperation, even though we were in the same office between the World at One and PM, you know, forget it. Now, I think that's changed for the better, though. I do think that competition and internal competition is not altogether a bad thing, because on the whole, it produces better programmes. What you have to try and do is make sure there isn't stupid waste of resource, because I think with Radio 4, and especially now that LBC is a different kind of radio station, there's no real external competition. So you have to somehow generate the hunger that you can see in Fleet Street, but without having a range of actual competitors to generate that. Of course, when you go to the Today programme, you realise that the scrutiny is even more intense, and I think it was about 10 days into the job that Michael Howard, as Home Secretary, was attacking me from the floor of the House of Commons for something that happened on the programme. And you also realise that you are actually in charge of the contracts of Brian Redhead and John Humphreys. And we knew when I went there was going to be a succession question around Brian. And the spotlight is unremitting. And the work is pretty terrible too. So the problem with the Today programme is that the peak pressure times are late night when the papers come in and you've got some new stories breaking, and first thing in the morning. So I would quite regularly be talking to the night team at 11:30, midnight, 1:30, and then also up at 5 o'clock looking at the running order. Probably the most dramatic was when Jonathan Aitken, who was then a cabinet minister, accused the Today programme of poisoning democracy. And he came up with a huge charge sheet about all the bad things we'd done. And it's quite sobering when a minister, a cabinet minister, attacks you, because you don't know two things. You don't know, is this the official government line, and do all ministers think this? And you've also got no idea whether the BBC backs you or not. And the BBC is very bad indeed at telling that you're supported. You get this building up press campaign about a programme in crisis, and you don't hear a word from your managers. And the curiosity in this was that about 10 days into this long-running row, John Humphreys, I think, was at the Sony Awards, and he went to the loo, and John Burt was in a loo next to him. And John Burt said, oh, we had a governor's meeting today, and we all backed you 100%, you know, jolly good, keep on going. And that's the first time any of us knew that the corporate BBC was actually supportive of this programme. I think it's probably true that by that stage, you know that there are some things I knew John Burt didn't like about the programme, which were things that I and most of the team believed in. So we believed in pretty ferocious, aggressive interviewing, and John thought sometimes we were going for cheap hits and cheap headlines, which indeed we were.
I think a lot of people would go along with you when you feel that women are unfairly discriminated against in this way, but where they wouldn't go along with you is the way that you would like to demolish the family.
When I was shadowing the programme before I became actual editor, I went into a studio where Sue McGregor was doing a pre-recorded interview, and I held the key down and said, ask him this. And at that point, she took her headphones off and put them on the table so she could no longer hear me. And that was the point at which I made it very clear that I expect presenters to put their headphones on and listen to the questions, or suggested questions. And Sue and I eventually ended up with a very good relationship in which we did trust each other. And certainly with John Humphreys and I, that during the 8 o'clock news, we would always just kick around what the 8-10 interview is going to be like. And John is one of the brightest people I've ever worked with. And John would say, so he answers that. And I say, well, you ask that. And we would game play an interview in about 5 minutes during the news. And mostly it went the way that you expected it to do. And obviously the other person I had an immensely close relationship with, and I'm godfather to his daughter, is Jim Nocte. And Jim Nocte, we had that symbiotic relationship on The World at One, and then Jim came to the Today programme as the successor to Brian Redhead. I think when you're looking at the Today programme, you also have to think about the mix of people on the programme. And I don't believe in golden ages, but I think we happen to be very lucky in that when we end up with Sue McGregor, a strong woman presenter who has that perfect honeyed English voice, albeit that she's actually from South Africa, but she's got that wonderful Radio 4 voice. You then have John, who's a bit chippy and Welsh and a bit sharper and has got a bit of crackle in the voice. And then you've got Jim as Edinburgh family doctor. And so you actually look for that mix that's going to work in as a presentation team. And sometimes you can look at a couple of presenters and just think, actually, you know, together they don't work very well, even though they are individually brilliant.
This is 5 Live on 909 and 693 Medium Wave. News and sport from the BBC.
Well, I was editor of the Today programme in 1996, with the general election only a year away, and what looked like a big general election with Blair potentially coming to power. And actually, I went into this period of being wooed very heavily by Tony Hall, who was then head of news, and by Jenny Abramsky, who was about to run Continuous News, who really wanted me to do 5 Live. I was tempted, but ultimately I just thought the Today programme was too big a gig to give up. We regarded 5 Live as being cocky upstart, and we didn't really want to help it or nurture it. I did indeed have one programme out producer who would jam all phone lines to people in the news with the Today programme's direct line, specifically so that 5 Live couldn't get through to people in the news. So 5 Live was not seen at the time as being a major player against Radio 4, I suppose. And there was this brilliant bit of psychology in which Jenny told me she had bumped into Will Wyatt, who was then managing director of BBC Television. And Will said, silly boy, you only get the offer of controllerships every so often. Whether he actually said that or not, I don't know, but it was a brilliant bit of psychology, because I then thought, ooh, this sounds a bit like I should be doing it. 5 Live was potentially great fun, and it gave me sport. Therefore, you think, well, actually, you know, maybe news and sport would be a good thing to do. So I did indeed go to 5 Live. The BBC hierarchy thought that 5 Live wasn't strong enough on news. I was put in there to sort the news out and beef the news up and make it much more on the map as a news station, and try and, you know, keep sport going, obviously, but to make sure that it was living up to the BBC News values.
Let me introduce to you our Ireland Affairs correspondent, Mark Devenport, who has an important announcement. Mark.
Yes, I've just heard the news.
Diana Madill had been doing the magazine on Five Live, and she wanted to move on. So we had this vacancy in what was a big show there. And it's one of those moments when serendipity happens and something comes to see you at exactly the right time. So Nicky Campbell came to see me with his agent, John Thoday, who is one of the most talented agents, though also supremely assertive. And John just came to see me and said, Nicky's decided he doesn't want to do Radio 1 anymore, he wants to do 5 Live. And I hadn't really listened to Nicky that much on Radio 1. So I wasn't particularly in tune with what he did. But I just thought, actually, you know, this is really, if we could make this work, the idea of a big Radio 1 presenter coming to 5 Live and doing a different kind of news that ultimately, I mean, what emerged, again with a great editor, Mark Sandell, was very much a pub conversation. So Nicky and Mark would come up with the idea that in a pub you may well talk about what's happening in politics that day and what you think about Tony Blair, but you also might talk about the cost of cabs or what Man United did last night, and creating a programme which is very fluid in its approach to news and sport. And the personality, in a way, bridges the fact that you've got two genres. And that was always Five Live's problem, that it was sitting there as a block of news and a block of sport. And sometimes very, very uncomfortably sitting next to each other. So, and listening to that wearing my Pennine radio head and my, you know, just radio anorak head, you think this is not a radio station that makes a great deal of sense. So it was trying to really create a sense of a radio station. And Nicky was vitally important to that.
It's 7:39. Well, it's the one I'll be asking on A Question of Sport in years to come.
And then the unsung hero of my time on Five Live was Julian Warwicker. And Julian was depping, really, when I went to Five Live. But John Inverdale moved on from a Drive Time show after probably I'd been there about a year. And Julian went in and I think both maintained and I suspect probably increased the ratings slightly, because Five Live at that time was generally going up. And then when Peter Allen and Jane Garvey wanted off Breakfast and we moved them to Drive, it was Julian who became the anchor of the Breakfast show with Victoria Derbyshire. The ratings were very strong, and we increased our audience figures very powerfully through that time, because I think Five Live was still growing as a radio station. We kept all the sport portfolio. We did make the news more credible. I'm much better at taking something that's been done already and trying to improve it. So Jenny Abramski she gets all the credit for being a pioneer of Five Live and inventing it as a station and giving it a really, really successful launch. What I think I did was take a bunch of built programmes. So Jenny commissioned, you know, a gay programme and a black programme and an Asian programme and this and that and the other. And I pretty much got rid of all of them to make it a much more fluid, sequence-based radio station. And I also wanted to make it, you know, young sounding and contemporary. So I think I did deliver over that 3 years a more contemporary, logical radio station. So that's what I was really proud of. Equally, I'll be completely honest that I think by the time I'd done the 3 years, I thought I'd done everything I could do with Five Live, because really you wanted to create something quite simple. So I almost absolutely deliberately took out a lot of the commissioning that you would do, because you end up with editors with big sequences who know what their audience wants and how to do it.
This is BBC Radio News from London. The death has been announced of Diana, Princess of Wales. She died in hospital in the early hours this morning after a car crash in central Paris. The Queen, the Prince of Wales, and her two sons have been informed of her death.
And we discovered that it was an August bank holiday weekend, so we discovered that almost all our presenters were away. So the rotary looked okay. So you have one set of people away one week and a different set of people away the other week, without thinking that they're all away on a Saturday night. And we rang Eddie Mayer on his mobile, and he was in Barcelona, and we rang. So we were trying to put together a set of people who would work in the end on a Radio 4 and Radio 5 Live joint programme. And where we were lucky was that Peter Allen was around and Jim Nottie was around. So we had a breakfast show that morning, which was Peter and Jim as a 4 and 5 Live combination. I think the moment when you hear it coming out of the Today studio that morning, the announcement that the Princess of Wales has died in a road accident, is just one of those truly shocking moments. And you knew that across the country, people were waking up on a Sunday morning at 6, 7, 8 a.m. to something which was the equivalent of Kennedy being shot, or one of those moments that's forever played in the archive. I suppose the shock drives you through the programme. And what you then got, of course, was we then got into more of the thinking about the tone and the style of this. Because Five Live is a station with a lot of phone-in elements, a lot of interactivity, even in those days. And I remember the one edict we had was that John Burt and the BBC didn't want us to open up the phone lines. And I think they were worried that somebody might come on and say, well, I never really wrote, you know, didn't mean anything much to me. So I think I'm right in saying it was almost 24 hours afterwards before we opened up any phone lines. And then I was asked to do the job of acting director of Continuous News, which was a real rag bag. We had an away day once in which we had Five Live and News 24 and BBC Online, BBC News Online, and the travel units, so the people doing the, you know, roadworks on the A38 and CFAX, and this is all the stuff that just wouldn't fit anywhere else. You had to try and create a department out of it. But I suppose a huge credit to Tony Hall that I'd never worked in television, and in the way that the BBC constantly reorganises itself and comes up with answers which it actually had 10 years ago, having done all this bi-media stuff and tri-media stuff, they then decided, you know what, it makes sense to organise as radio and television. So they created Head of Television News and Head of Radio News, and Steve Mitchell and I both wanted to be Head of TV News because it was a more glamorous thing, and Tony made a great leap of faith and appointed someone who'd never worked in television, which is me, to lead Television News. I hugely like the power of television. I think there's a great magic in the way the machine operates and all these video reports coming from around the world. And I think if you've never done television, you can't resist the opportunity to have a bit of a go at television. I've never liked television news as a medium as much as I like the Today Problem and World at One. I think if you can edit in one medium, you can edit in the other. But does it give you the same excitement as sitting there on the World at One at 1 minute past one? Well, not quite.
The International Olympic Committee has the honour of announcing that the Games of the 30th Olympiad in 2012 are awarded to the city of London.
Well, I'd been director of sport, so I'd been director of sport for 3 years, and we went to Beijing for the Olympics. In Beijing, and on the way back from Beijing, there was a conversation with Mark Thompson and Mark Byford, in which it sounds banal, but we realised the Olympics were very, 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 very big. And Seb Coe used to laugh at me about this, because I went to a conference once and said, when we went to Beijing, we realised the Olympics were big. And Seb said, you know, Roger's amazing revelation, the Olympics are big. But I think we just got the scale of it, and we got the scale of it when Planet Olympics descends in your host city. It is this most massive moment in your national life and defines all sorts of things. So the idea came up that there would be a dedicated director for London 2012, and that it would deliberately try and break across all the genres. So it wasn't just about doing the sport. It was about the news coverage, it was about the torch relay, it was about the cultural Olympiad, it was about what local radio did, it was about everybody in the BBC working together to deliver the Olympics. So I was asked to do that, and you go from running a big division of 500 or 600 people to sitting in an office with just me, a PA, and the wonderful Amanda Farnsworth, my project executive. And you don't really have any levers, you don't really have any budget in the same way as other people do, you don't really have any way of making things happen. So you have to adopt a very different approach. And I think probably the polar opposite of the Today Programme, where you say, this is a lead, this is what we're doing, you go there, you do that. And in the Olympics job, you couldn't do that. It was what you would call in modern management jargon, managing stakeholders, and having to try to get the various operations working together to deliver what we wanted in the BBC.
Welcome to the throne room. It's designed by John Nash. You'll notice again the colours, gold, white, and green.
Well, in the opening ceremony, I could, of course, gone to the opening ceremony, and, you know, one of the great sadnesses of the Olympics is I had a ticket that would get me anywhere. And in fact, of course, you're actually in the office watching the programme and making sure that the commentators are doing the right thing and that you've got the right shots in. And of course, we didn't know at the time that it was going to be the most watched broadcast of the modern television's ratings era. But you do know this is an ultimately defining moment. And I think we were all scarred in the BBC by the fact that the Royal Jubilee pageant scandal had happened only a couple of months before, in which the BBC was adjudged to have done disrespectful coverage of the royal pageant. And therefore, we knew that in the modern media world and the Twitter world and everything else, that if you screw up at the beginning of something, it's very hard to recover from it. And that what you essentially need to do is create a narrative of BBC and British and London 2012 success that was mutually reinforcing. And therefore, getting the opening ceremony right, getting the first day right, was even more crucial than anything else you do, because that's the moment when people sample it. You can see in what happened in the Olympics a vision of what the BBC could be like, because the BBC working together for a single goal. When we did the BBC values in 2003, we had a value which was, we are one BBC, great things happen when we work together. And it sounds like Mooney-type mantra, but it's true. And you saw there the power of the BBC as a national organisation which can unite everybody and play all its platforms to a great goal. So I felt overwhelmingly pride in the BBC and pride in what the country had achieved. And I've discovered there are two things in my life that make me weepy. One of them is graduation ceremonies at Cambridge, and the other one is the Olympic Games. And I wasn't quite as bad as Dave Gordon, head of Olympic sport, who wept at the slightest provocation, but certainly most of the last 48 hours I was pretty dewy-eyed and during the closing ceremony. And I just found it an immensely powerful emotional experience, as well as the thing I'm most proud of in my professional career. There were two things. One was during the Savile crisis, which was the worst part of the BBC and was 2 months after the Olympics, that you go into this period in which it was principally about an evil man and what he'd done, but was a crisis at the heart of the whole BBC. And I was asked to help try to lead the business continuity through that. So while George ran the DG functions, I was trying to keep the show afloat, which was immensely difficult and obviously only slightly successful. But then when Tony Hall came in, there was a period of about 6 weeks during that summer where I was acting DG when Tony was on holiday or on courses. So I did technically, my last day in the BBC, I was acting Director General on my last day, which felt like a closure of a journey, while equally being completely certain that A, I wanted to leave the BBC, and B, I would never have wanted to be Director General. So I think if you see the way the BBC has eaten up and spat out Directors General, it's not something you'd want to do. And I think the organisation is incredibly difficult to manage. So I feel very lucky that I had jobs that were scalable and I could do, and not being put into the position where it's pretty much a no-win game being Director General. And I think during that summer, even in 2013, when the height of the crisis had gone, you'd often spend a day as acting Director General with the press office telling you about story one that's breaking, that's bad, story two that's breaking, that's bad, story three that puts management in a bad light. And then you'd get home and at 10 o'clock at night they'd ring you and say that actually a newspaper has gone with story four, which is even worse than the ones we were thinking about. And you just think, is that the way I want to spend my life? And when you set off wanting to make radio or wanting to do great programmes, do you want to be constantly... And what one of my colleagues said, and I didn't get quite as bad as this, but she said that during the last year she was in the BBC, that every time the phone rang, she had a sense of dread. And that isn't the way you want to spend your life. I suppose your family is always very proud of the fact you work for the BBC. People still look up to the BBC, still think it's a wonderful national institution. You're very proud to be part of that. And I remember when my dad was very ill, that he listened to the Today programme and called himself the Northern editor of the programme, or give me feedback on that day's programme. And sometimes I rang him up, he'd made a list of what he'd heard in that programme. And that is something that, you know, is very valuable to you and, you know, the people that you love. I suppose I feel very privileged in the fact I've worked in a whole load of areas which were fantastically stimulating. And I suppose, you know, you can't get to the level I'm in the BBC without having your detractors and people who think you're, you know, crap or whatever it is you're doing. But I think most people in the end thought I was a good editor and had a good sense of editorial judgment. I suppose I also want to my own memories of the BBC to be quite warm. So even though, you know, there are times you're critical of the BBC, there are times you think the BBC isn't quite doing the right thing, but as an institution that matters to this country and which gives people like me great careers and a wonderful time there, you can't beat it.